This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. And are you interested in bond trading? At Interactive Brokers Bond Marketplace, you can access over 1 million global bonds, including government, corporate, and municipal bonds, all in one place. With IBKR's bond search tool, finding and comparing yields against other brokers has never been easier, streamlining your investment decisions. Plus, you can trade U.S. Treasuries around the clock, 5 days a week, allowing you to react to market news and economic events whenever they happen. Enjoy bond trading with no markups or built-in spreads and low, transparent commissions, which can help you improve your returns. Rated a top online broker, Interactive Brokers has won awards from Barron's and Investopedia, stockbrokers.com, and has been Benzinga's number one overall online broker for bonds for 4 years in a row. The best-informed investors choose Interactive Brokers, member SIPC. Visit IBKR.com/bonds and start trading today.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The three big E's: election, economics, and earnings. Wondering if too much diversification is a bad thing? We're taking a bird's eye view of the economy and markets with our guest today, Tom Nelson, Senior Vice President and Head of Asset Allocation for Franklin Templeton. All this and much more on episode number 894 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Election noise. There's a lot of it, isn't there? Oh my gosh. Pre-election, post-election, lots of things that we have to get through in order to understand really what is going on. I mean, what we're seeing right now is a lot of what's called price discovery. Price discovery is the idea that people are looking for what is going to be the right price based on the various things that are going on. So for example, we know that now President Trump is, of course, the president-elect. And he has a lot of ideas. But how many of those ideas will actually get through? How many of those ideas are going to make an impact? What is it going to mean to this stock, this sector, et cetera? That's what's happening. So we're going to stop with that for a second. We're going to step aside from all of this until it clears. That's exactly what you should be doing. Stop listening to all the various things of this stock going up because we think that there's going to be tariffs. We see that, in fact, one of the best performing sectors last week, funny enough, was retail, which should be the hardest hit when it comes to tariffs. But yet at the same time, there's been a lot of players saying, well, it's going to be only certain stocks that will be hit if this happens. And in fact, we don't even know what the tariffs are going to be and how it's going to work. So let's just stop all the craziness right now. Let's just put it aside and get back to the business of what we're doing. For now, listen, thanks for joining me this week. I'm really happy to have this particular guest on today as we get closer to the end of the year. This is the time that we start to think about things like planning. We start to think about how do we want our portfolio allocated. It gives us a moment right now to stop thinking about all the different ideas that are swirling around due to this particular party is going to take control of the Senate and the House and the White House, or not. You know, all those things that went into this particular week, the anxiety that went along with it, and then the incredible pop that we saw, I think that's important. Just take a second. We saw that there was an employment report, and I went back, that was last week, I went back and I wanted to look at this. I wanted to see what exactly was going on with the employment report, because it was a pretty, I would say, dour number from the looks of it, right? But I wanted to understand what was going on with this employment report. A lot of discussion of how concerning it was. And it was. I looked at the ADP report, the official private payrolls from ADP that comes out a couple of days before the employment report is actually released. And it was a good number. We saw a really good number of private payroll additions. And then we saw that the official report from the government showed 28,000 lost of private payrolls. That was the official government release. The official government release was 28,000 loss, and we saw plus 200,000 from ADP. It was revised, the overall numbers, by 100,000 employed adding to the payrolls, less than was expected for the previous month. So that's not good. But employment rate, it's stuck at 4.1%. And the reason? Well, it's the statistical process, stats. As Mr. Eckstein said in sixth grade, figures don't lie, but liars always try to figure, right? And statistics are that kind of mechanism that allows for us to get a significant amount of looky-loosey anywhere we want in the numbers. Now, I'm not thrilled, to be honest, about the number, but there were some offsetting items. Let's remember that only 112,000, only 28,000 was lost in the private, but we saw that there was a gain overall. But here's the thing. Boeing strike played a major concern. The storms, the weather, this was real. The conflict that we all have is what side to believe of all this. It's not political. It's just, do we believe that things are going and falling off a cliff from an economic standpoint? Or do we think that maybe it's not as bad as we think? Do we think that the employment situation is horrible or is it an aberration? I think we could also look at the revisions and say that both months are not good. So there it is. But some of the numbers, they just don't make sense to me. Wages and services are strong. GDP is still growing at a good clip. Maybe some of these are backward-looking. I'll take that argument. I'll go with that. But I'm also going to blame a temporary issue, the concern over the election outcome. People got spun up. Companies said, you know what, I just don't want to do anything right now. And with that in mind, I think that there was a lot of headwinds in the employment issue. And when we look at that, I think that there is a concern about the number. The Fed is definitely on it with dropping rates by 0.25% last week, right? But I think we're going to see once the next month comes out, and we have to think about what is going to be happening with regard to all this, inclusive of the election. You know, I got some interesting stories. I got people in certain businesses that called me up and said, you know, I got to tell you, Tuesday, once the election was known, Wednesday, once it was definitely done, I started getting, not me, but this is what they told me, calls for people wanting to buy this or that. All of a sudden, it picked up. Now, why? Here's something interesting. Think about this for a second. If we think that there are going to be these tariffs, and if we think there are going to be all of these potential for higher prices in the future due to some of the ways that this administration believes that they can actually make money and tax, maybe people are saying, you know what? I better buy my stuff now. Before prices go up, before the tariffs are put on, I better get busy. And if I get busy now, I'll save myself money in the future. A pull forward effect is possible. Now, we've talked about this over the years on different aspects of different things, and it happens. In fact, we may see a significant pull forward effect over the next quarter or so. And that's going to put a screwing to the Fed's idea that they can continue reducing rates. This 25 basis point cut that they did this week, okay, that was in the bag. Are they going to do one in December? And what about next year? Right now, the betting and the odds are in the Treasury markets that there's only going to be about 2 rate cuts next year. I, as I've been telling you this before, have been very much thinking that the rate cuts that everybody expected, like a 2% rate cut this year in 2024, that didn't pan out as it is. The Fed was with his back up against the wall, of course, so they had to do something. The employment numbers are not great, and there's certain pockets of things around the country that aren't great. Rates are actually going up, and that's a problem too. Now, the Fed, again, is going to be in a really hard position moving forward, but they don't care because they don't care if they're wrong. And I'm not going to get into a whole rant about the Fed and their economic outlooks that are awful, because I want to talk about earnings. I want to talk about another E in the big E's, right? The earnings, the economics that we have, the election, but earnings, another E in the big three E's. Mixed bag, clearly we know. We've got some winners. We got our holding in Palantir last week, and we got some losers out there. For example, like Microsoft, we hold both of those. Toast, which I've been mentioning before, big numbers. Overall good in what we know and we saw, generally speaking. And obviously, that's why we see the S&P 500 closing in on 6,000. Numbers have been good, even with all the pricing pressures and headwinds. And overall, I think we have to say, we have to all agree, that companies have been able to avoid some of the minefields, and I guess make lemons out of lemonade. That's really what has been happening, and it's really been good to see. And that is why we're seeing such good numbers, on top of the fact that the idea that deregulation, softer economic numbers aren't going to be a big issue moving forward. The soft landing could be really realized at this point, even though I thought it was going to be a no landing, due to the fact that, well, we have a whole different regime in there that's going to attack things at a much different way starting next year. So confidence is probably going to be up. Whether or not you like Trump or not is not the point, because it doesn't matter now. If you have an hysteria over this, get over it. We're here to make money. That's what we're here for. This isn't the coochie coo politics show. That's not what the Disciplined Investor is all about. It's all about investing in a disciplined manner. With that, we're going to stop. Because again, I want to leave that behind us and kind of wait a couple of weeks or so to really understand more about what's happening and how the markets are absorbing all this, and get on with our guest today. And our guest today is Tom Nelson. He's the Senior Vice President and Head of Asset Allocation Portfolio Manager for Franklin Templeton Investment Solutions. He's a member of the Investment Strategy and Research Committee, which means he's the guy that's helping oversee exactly what's going on from a big picture down to what happens inside of the mutual funds. He's a portfolio manager of a number of funds offered for sale in various jurisdictions. He's a lead portfolio manager of the Franklin Next Step Fund Series, the Franklin Vol Smart Allocation VIP Fund, and numerous model portfolio programs. Also a manager of the Franklin Life Smart Retirement Target Funds, which I want to talk to you about, and the Franklin Fund Allocator Series, available in the U.S. and several institutional portfolio, custom institutional mandates. Anyway, Tom, welcome back.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You know, it's interesting because I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the things. The reason I wanted to have you on was not because, you know, of the election that we just had and all the things of trying to figure out, oh, you know, if this one won or that one or this one. We've gone through that. We know where we are now. Now we just have to let the markets deal with it, okay? But I really want to talk about, like, under a normal end-of-year series, right? Like, kind of the things we could start thinking about as investors. Some of the things that we could start looking at. I wanted to start with a discussion about big picture, about asset allocation. And, you know, how we can set our portfolios up so that, in fact, we don't have to necessarily worry about, oh, what's going to happen with, oh, the January effect, or what's going to happen with the election like we just saw, right? Or what's going to happen if there's a war that escalates in, I don't know, pick your poison here, Taiwan. Mm-hmm. Let's go back to basics. Asset allocation, as you see it. What is it? And maybe even expand on what it isn't.
Yeah. So according to Microsoft Copilot.
Oh, bring the AI.
I have to start with a little AI, right? Copilot says, and I would generally agree, that asset allocation is the process of dividing an investment portfolio among different asset categories, such as stocks, bonds, and cash. The primary goal is to balance risk and reward based upon an individual's financial goals, risk tolerance, and investment horizon. So maybe said another way, it's the process of constructing a portfolio across multiple beyond just asset classes, regions, countries, sectors, and styles, with the goal of meeting client objectives. And that's not necessarily just, you know, risk tolerance, but it's typically around the level of risk that an investor can tolerate. And really, while there are no free lunches in finance, diversification is about as close as you can get, right? Investing across asset classes can generally produce a smoother return stream through reduced risk without sacrificing equivalent levels of expected returns, right? And that stability should help investors to sleep well at night. And over the long term, you'll generally be able to have a portfolio that endures. And you listed a number of the different strategies that I'm involved in. And for example, the Franklin Moderate Allocation Fund. This isn't a, you know, this isn't a product pitch or anything, but just an example of a strategy that the strategy's been around since 1996. So just about 28 years. And over that 28-year period, and this is indicative of many funds of this ilk, it's delivered 88% of the returns of stocks with 65% of the risk. So most of the return and about a third less risk. And if you were to kind of break that time period out over the last 28 years into rolling 5-year periods at the end of each month since the inception of the strategy, there have been zero periods of negative returns, while stocks, actually, if you measured the last 5 years, over the last 28 years, the last 5 years at the end of each month, stocks have been negative 20% of the time. Mm. And if you were to break that down into a little bit finer increments over any rolling 12-month period, or kind of with a one-year look back, when stocks are down, 94% of the time the fund is outperformed, with an average outperformance of 7.6% in those down periods for stocks. And similarly, when bonds are down in any 12-month period, 86% of the time, the funds outperformed with an average outperformance relative to bonds of 9.5%. And so that's a story that's similar to well-managed asset allocation portfolios with a moderate level of risk, but really helps to stabilize performance over the time and keep you well-diversified through all markets and through all sorts of geopolitical events and so on and so forth. And really, you know, the key is to provide diversification and stability at an appropriate level of risk for the investor.
So let's wind that back for a second. There's a couple of key points here that I want to expand on. The first thing you talked about was a certain return with less risk. That's what we talk about. And that's something that we, in the business, I talk to clients about, risk-adjusted return. And what's that? Well, some clients are like, well, I just want to make as much money as I can. Well, they don't care about risk-adjusted return, right? They're just looking to make it happen. Drawdowns are okay. But in the end, sometime in the future, I want a lot more, whatever that quantifies as, right? Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of people that look at risk-adjusted return like, well, how much downside has there been in certain circumstances to get me to that point? Or what's the volatility, like a standard deviation? How do you factor that into a long-term horizon where risk does have a habit of dissipating over long periods of time, right?
Yeah. And so what we generally will do for long periods of time is we've got a team of analysts that do asset allocation research and they report up into me. Part of their process is every year they deliver a set of long-term return expectations. And they're kind of a mixture of historical returns and kind of valuation-driven estimates of what to expect over the coming 10 years, if you will. And we utilize those as key inputs into what we refer to as a strategic asset allocation process. And that's kind of setting a portfolio's allocations, assuming that we were investing over the next decade without going in and making any changes in the interim. Mm-hmm. And through that process, we will generally come out with what the expected returns to a given portfolio are and the expected level of risk to be taken in order to achieve those expected returns. Obviously, there's no guarantee of any of that, but that really helps to guide us and is a good way of starting conversation with clients that basically run through a number of different scenarios. It gives us a sense for how much they can expect to achieve in risk and in return, and how much uncertainty or risk that comes with it. And potentially we can also, you know, turn that into the probabilities of a certain drawdown of their portfolio value, because oftentimes people will think of risk in terms of how much money can I potentially lose, or if any, right?
Right.
And so that's just part of our annual process of setting kind of strategic weights for portfolios.
You know, it's interesting because, not to get in the weeds here, and I'm going to throw some things. All right, everybody who's like listening right now, just don't freak out, because I'm going to throw some statistical comments at this discussion. When you look at something like a Morningstar and you look at all the things, if anybody does look at like a mutual fund, for example, or an ETF or some investment, there are these risk adjusted, I think they call them, there's a variety of different ways to look at the Morningstar risk adjusted returns. There's things like Trainer ratio or Sharpe ratio or standard deviation. These are all, there's a few others, beta, alpha. There's a few other ones that you look at, and you can, by looking at these, understand that if a fund, for example, which is properly identified in its appropriate risk category or its appropriate asset category, has, let's say, a very high over one alpha, well, you can say, well, you know what? From a risk-adjusted standpoint, there may be something to look at there. Whereas if it's a negative, what's going on there? Same thing with some of these other numbers that they all operate a little bit differently. But these are all the things that you're looking on a regular basis, right?
Yes. Yeah. And they're great ways to measure and compare various funds or strategies with similar but maybe not identical objectives, right? In terms of how much return was achieved, and this is generally backward looking, right, over the last 3 years or 5 years or 10 years, how much return has been achieved given the amount of risk taken in order to achieve those returns, right? And so through that lens, I'm just, you know, kind of make up some numbers here, but a fund that returns 5% with a 10% level of risk, and so that ratio of just return to risk would be 0.5, would look very different from a fund that returned 8% and took a similar level of risk at 10%, right?
Right.
And so you're kind of normalizing things, and that enables some apples to apples comparisons of one fund or one strategy to another.
Yeah. And that's an important thing, because obviously if we can get a better return with less risk, now some people may be thinking, Tom, you know, hey, who cares if I get 8% over 10 years, who cares how I got there? And my answer would be, and tell me your thoughts, is yes. But if you took the way that it was a very smooth ride, it probably was one that would have held you in that strategy versus one that had a choppy ride that you may have been thrown off the horse, so to speak, that was bucking and you never got back on.
Yeah.
So, and you know, a lot of people are like, well, that's not me. Yes, it is. You know, you're in something, you start getting nervous. You know, it's like, oh, what do I care? No, you care. You take a 20% downside on something versus something else that's hanging on pretty well. You're able to handle those dips and moves a lot better emotionally.
Yep.
And keeps you on the straight and narrow. And it just makes your life a lot easier. It makes it a much more pleasant experience overall. And by the way, I was thinking about your AI answer, why it was probably so familiar to it. They probably ripped off one of your writings. That's how they got it. Right. That's what AI is doing. It's ripping us all off anyway. So when it comes to asset allocation, it's not a set it and forget it. We know that. It's not something where you just, okay, that's done, right? Because things change due to factors. Give me some examples.
So in terms of too much diversification?
No, changing your diversification asset allocation.
Oh.
Like, why would you change things?
So we talked a little bit about, you know, the strategic, that long-term, but we do subscribe to the notion that asset classes can come into or out of favor over a kind of a full economic cycle. And given where we are within that cycle, are things, you can kind of break things into, are things good? Are they bad? Are they getting better? Are they getting worse? in terms of just economic growth and earnings growth and things along those lines. And sticking with the economic growth example, there are very distinct and different returns to various asset classes through those kind of four different phases: good, bad, getting better, getting worse, right? Mm-hmm. And generally, when the economy is good and it's getting better, stocks tend to do really well. Mm-hmm. When the economy is weak and getting worse, stocks do quite poorly. And so there's this notion of dynamic asset allocation or tactical asset allocation that we will utilize in portfolios to kind of lean into or lean out of asset classes, given kind of where we are in the cycle and our research team's assessment of the outlook for things. And so, you know, generally when things are getting good, when things are good and getting better, we'll generally be overweight stocks. When things are bad and getting worse, we'll generally be underweight stocks. And, you know, we'll have a little bit more risk or a little bit less risk.
And this can be broken down. This could be broken down even further. I assume, like, for example, hey, things are good and the employment situation is good and interest rates are coming down. Well, ding, 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 small caps, right?
Yes. Yeah.
You know, whereas interest rates coming up, concern about credit quality and credit availability of getting loans and, yep. You know, the price is higher slash, you know, economy may be slowing. Well, puts an X mark on the small cap side.
Yep. Yeah. And there's this kind of mosaic that we put together across the growth backdrop, across inflation and interest rates, across policy. And there are definitely linkages between policy, particularly like monetary policy from the Federal Reserve and interest rates. And then also like sentiment and positioning. And we'll take all of those things kind of together and come up with, you know, generally a thesis. And that's usually with kind of a 6 to 12 month outlook on things.
I like that. A investment mosaic. Now, what's the difference between that and a matrix? Or just mosaic sounds a lot cooler? More
mosaic sounds cooler. That's what we call their internal.
I like it.
Tools to analyze portfolios. Mosaic.
No, so. Because mosaic, I'm getting more colors. I'm getting more warmth, and I'm getting kind of like this artistic and this really multidimensional. Where matrix is just like, it's just like a spreadsheet with information left, right, down, center. That's it. So that's smart.
Got a lot of marketing people that help to come up with that.
Well, you know what I say. If you can't get them with the numbers, as well, and with colors. All right. So breaking this down to the individual investor, back to changing and tactically looking at things, tactical investing from an asset allocation standpoint, right? The average person out there that has a good swath of diversification, what level of, now this is hard to answer, but what level of tactical, how tight, like should somebody be saying, well, you know, I see that there's a potential for a flare up in Ukraine, should they be pushing more into wheat and commodities, or is that just kind of a little bit too precise?
Yeah. There is no perfect answer, of course. And generally we'll work with investors when we think about things from our investment committee. We talked about some, you know, different ratios of measuring risk to reward and things along those lines. And one of there's a couple of different measures. One is tracking error. And basically that measures how different your portfolio positioning looks relative to your benchmark. You know, how closely or not closely do we track to that benchmark? And so we have.
So give me an example of that. So if you have a benchmark that returns 10%, your portfolio returns 11, is your tracking error plus one?
So our active return is plus one, but if the difference in risk between the portfolio and the benchmark is, call it 2%, another measure is the information ratio. How much active return do you achieve relative to your benchmark? How much did you outperform or underperform, given the amount of risk that you took in order to get in order to achieve that return? So for an active return of positive 1%, if you take 2% active risk, that's an information ratio of 0.5. And generally an IR, if you will, of 0.5 or above is considered to be good. And so we'll will calibrate how much tracking we have relative to the benchmark, given our views of the world, as well as how large of a conviction we have in those views, and then also how much risk any active decision actually generates in a portfolio. So for example, small cap stocks are quite risky relative to, you know, to the broad market. So if we were to go call it overweight 1% in small caps, that would generate more active risk than if we were to go overweight, say, utility stocks, which are much more lower in risk, more stable investments, higher levels of income overall. And so if we had the same amount of conviction on utilities versus small caps, in order to generate an equivalent amount of active risk, we would take a smaller active position in small caps than we would in utilities.
Yeah, gotcha. Gotcha.
And it's kind of putting all those pieces together in terms of what we like, what we don't like, how much we like of things and or how little we like of those things, and how much risk each of those decisions on kind of a marginal contribution basis adds to the portfolio, and putting that all together to come up with something that has a target tracking error that is aligned with what we're telling investors, you know, they should normally expect, and is consistent with our views of the world at any given point in time.
Yeah, no, that's good stuff. That's important. And obviously the idea of trying to implement this, but with the ideas, but then going back and measuring how well we did, right? As an individual or institution, however you want to look at it, right? If somebody who's doing it on their own, or that's important, looking back, okay, how was it? Okay, good decisions, how did I do? And then making better judgments in the future based on all that information that you can discern.
Yep. Great. And we like to measure that before making any investment decisions. And then obviously on an ex post basis, after we've, you know, made the decisions and implemented them in portfolios, how did they actually do?
Right. Good stuff. Hang on. We're going to go take a quick break. And then I want to get back. I want to talk about some of your high level views on macro inflation and maybe a little bit. We're going to touch on the Fed and some of the things that are going on. We'll be right back. And let's take a moment to talk about Interactive Brokers. And in particular, I want to talk about Portfolio Analyst, which helps sophisticated investors like you understand the health of your complete financial portfolio. Portfolio Analyst is free. Yes, that's free. And easy to use personal finance software that creates a consolidated view of banking, of brokerage, and also your credit card accounts. Compare your entire consolidated portfolio against more than 200 benchmarks or create customized benchmarks for analyzing performance. You can even calculate time and money weighted rate of returns and use Portfolio Analyst for forecasting. Pretty cool. Check it out. Sign up for free. Again, free at PortfolioAnalyst.com. And we're back with Tom Nelson. He's a high ranking official over at Franklin Templeton. He's a good friend of mine also. We have something in common, Tom and I. Tom, you know what that is?
There could be a couple of different things, but what are you thinking?
Our wives do not listen to any time we talk about anything related to financial stuff.
Oh, goodness. You sound like Charlie Brown's teacher.
We talked about this the other night, actually.
Yeah.
When we left, I wanted to talk about some big picture on growth. We've had a couple of years of really great returns. I mean, I don't think we could not deny that. And pretty much the everything rally, generally speaking, post 2022, bonds came back, came down very well in terms of yield, prices up, commodities did great, gold on the fire, stocks, obviously don't have to talk about that. Small caps lagging, but big caps and all that doing great, international emerging. Is there something... Absolute return maybe doesn't done that well, but they don't ever do well. But the point is, it seems like the economy, generally speaking, is running fine. We saw some numbers a couple of weeks back on GDP numbers that looked pretty good. We saw the manufacturing and service number looking okay, better. Consumer confidence up there. So inflation relatively under control. Jobs numbers okay. They're noisy from month to month, but they're in good shape. So the Fed insists on more cuts to come from everything that we've seen.
Yep.
Is this, from your years of doing this, just like they're saying it and hoping to God they're right?
No, I think that we're in a pretty good spot. So there's a couple of things that you had mentioned there. And first, this was a kind of a chart of the day that I'd received in my inbox just the other day. And I think this is kind of ties in with a couple of things that we've been talking about. But since the lows in October of 2023 and the highs just recently in October, the S&P 500, so U.S. equities, up 40%. That's like massive, right?
Yep.
And this rally was achieved on volatility or risk of 12%. And so, you know, when you think about a Sharpe ratio, and this is just a very, you know, dirty way of doing it, but it's, you know, your return given the amount of risk is above 3.
That's huge.
That's only happened 3 other times in the last 40 years.
Yeah.
In 1995, in 1997, and in 2018. So over the last year, this has been one of the greatest risk-adjusted yearly returns in the history of the S&P 500. So just to kind of—
Do all those years have something in common, though? Let's see, 1995, let me think about this. 1995, mm-hmm. 1998, and 2018. So we were in a risk-cutting environment in two of those, right?
Two of those were pre-kind of tech bubble bursting.
Yeah.
But we had really strong economic growth. We had you know, periods of just massive kind of tech innovation.
Yep.
And there are some similarities there today. 2018, that was after there was like a Volmageddon episode where volatility had
I remember that like it was yesterday, by the way, because I remember watching that going, okay, what's happening? And I actually picked up a position and then I'm like, oh, that's not a good idea.
and stocks, you know, dropped precipitously, but then had a really nice run over the next 12 months. And so I'm not sure, but there's a lot that you can kind of read into in that. But yeah, like today we're in a really good spot in terms of growth, right? Good and getting better on that matrix in most countries, not everywhere. Certainly led by the U.S. There are areas of weakness like Europe, for example, and so the growth backdrop is really good and it's really solid. Corporates have proven to be resilient. The consumer is proving to be resilient. Not all stratas, but it's really the kind of the top 20%, the top quintile of consumers. Is responsible for about 50% of consumer spending across the U.S.
Yeah, so let's tax the hell out of them. How about that? Let's tax the hell out of them. That was a concept that was coming across.
Yeah.
Well, we go through that. But so the Fed, back to the Fed. Let me bring you back here. I get that.
Yeah.
Where in any of that is the story of when we write the history books back 10 years from now, oh, we need more rate cuts at this point come in?
I think things are coming in is first off, the Fed over the last, call it like 2.5 years, has been or was aggressively hiking interest rates to try to break the back of inflation, right? It was the worst inflation that we've seen since the early 1980s. And the Fed had to get really aggressive in taking short-term interest rates basically from zero to basically 5%. And that job is mostly done. And I think relative to what everyone's expectation was at the time when they embarked upon that hiking cycle, they've done a pretty darn good job. Inflation's come down. It's not down to the kind of magic 2% and perhaps won't. Maybe 2.5 to 3 is going to be our kind of our new normal inflation rates. But inflation really has come down, and they've been able to manage that without materially impacting economic growth. Right. Mm-hmm. And sitting here today, I don't think most of us would have expected us to not have seen a recession yet. And sitting here today, the probability of a recession over the next, call it 12 months, is quite low. But short term interest rates are really high, and they're really high relative to history. And in some cases, that's leading to, you know, issues with housing affordability. And so, like, for example, if you were to look at the median home price today versus, call it 4 years ago in 2020, so right around the last presidential election, housing prices are up a bit, but mortgage rates have gone from like 3% to 7%. Mm-hmm. So putting 20% down, buying a house at today's mortgage rates with the median home price, your monthly mortgage payment today is almost exactly double where it was at the last presidential election. That is really hurting the lower end of the consumer. And so the Fed has the ability, I think, right now to, we'll call it more of a normalization of interest rates by reducing short-term interest rates, which should be a net positive to corporates, mm-hmm. Corporates who are borrowing to fund their businesses. Mortgage rates will come down with that, and that should generally be a positive for economic growth.
But Tom, if the point is that all these people that can't afford houses, what we're going to do is, okay, let's lower rates so they can buy houses. Isn't that just going to push up housing prices?
That could.
I mean, like, if they, let me tell you my 2 cents on this, Tom. Ready? Yeah. Then they can't buy the house. If they can't afford the house, they shouldn't buy the house. And if the housing prices are too high for them, they should not buy the house. Therefore, it will actually take a load off the housing price index and maybe actually lower prices.
Yeah.
Nobody said that your home is supposed to be. My parents bought a home back in whatever year it was. I think it was for $42,000. They maybe sold it for like $65,000 20 years later. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're living in a house. It's a utility. It's like a car. It's like expecting to buy a car or a boat and for it to go up in value. We've had that recently, but that's not the norm. Yeah. So I don't know. Maybe that's why we're seeing such. Well, let's skip right over to gold and the inflation rate and things that are going on. Gold, the dollar's been rising. Gold has been going up. We're hearing that China and other central banks are buying. I mean, is this something that you guys are in on?
We're not active owners of gold, but it is something that we keep a watchful eye on. We can own it in some portfolios. I think that you hit upon, you know, the fears of inflation reaccelerating, and I think the one thing that the Fed more than anything else needs to be careful with is not hiking too quickly not easing too quickly or too aggressively, and overheating the economy, right? And so inflation is a bit of a concern. It's hard to know sitting here today, ultimately, what sort of policies will be implemented in a new presidential cycle. But the expectation is that it's likely going to be somewhat inflationary. And so there's that. And then beyond that, I would say the fiscal deficit is something that is really concerning. And there's no real easy fix. But that, you know, that kind of leads into gold as a store of value, if you will. Now, sitting here today, from a technical perspective, gold is about as overextended as it's been over the last 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, other similar time frames where technical signals were flashing kind of similar warnings were the summers of 2020. In 2011, as well as late 2007, all of which were followed up by double-digit percentage declines in gold. So, I'm not necessarily one to, to poo-poo the idea of gold, but you know, using history as a guide, timing today might not be perfect, but there are definitely good reasons to consider gold as an inflation hedge. And as a, you know, quote unquote speculative position as well.
I want to wrap up with a conversation about international equities and U.S. equities. Mm-hmm. Anybody that's in the business that has U.S. Equities as a core of their investments, mutual fund companies, ETF companies, asset allocators, diversifiers, you know, obviously that's a lot of it. And one of the things that comes up is this idea of, well, we've seen historically that international equities, and you can pick what that is, whether it's EFA, which is Europe, Australasia, and the Far East, whether it's emerging markets, frontier markets, you know, some of the smaller ones out there that are hard to invest in, whether it's, you know, the North America, ex-US, whatever you want to call it, right? Some kind of yeah. international non-US brings a significant amount of diversification, asset allocation, beneficial, lowering down the temperature of a portfolio, aids in performance, all this stuff. You know what they're talking about, right? Yep. That's yep. all of the research points to that. Yet, why, if people are looking for not absolute return, that's a bad word, not just total return, regardless of risk, why, when the international over the last number of years seems to be a perennial underperformer under every category, economically, stock-wise, why should we, is it really that good that we need to include it?
It's a very good question. So most of our portfolio, we're a global team, we're a global firm. Most of our portfolios are global. We do have in portfolios that we manage in the US, a home bias. We are also overweight the US relative to the rest of the world today on kind of a DAA or a dynamic perspective. And to your point, the US has outperformed the rest of the world basically since the end of the global financial crisis and even a little bit further beyond that. And I think some of that has to do with the US and the innovation. While regions like Europe have lagged in terms of innovation, really on a grand scale. And here's a really interesting stat that I read over the weekend. And that is that Europe is stuck in a static industrial structure with few companies rising up to disrupt existing industries or develop new growth engines. And here's the cool quote. There's no European company with a market capitalization over 100 billion euros that's been set up from scratch over the last 50 years. 50 years? 50.
Wow.
Yeah, 5 years.
Wow.
Well, all six U.S. companies with a valuation above 1 trillion euros have been created during this period.
Yeah, because they're more interested in a four-day work week and a 34-hour week and their pension benefits. That's the way it looks to me, at least. And that's why I keep coming back to, like, okay, so what's so good about this here?
Yeah.
And how is Germany hitting all-time highs? And how is this and that? I just don't understand any of
it. Yeah. The one thing that is kind of the caveat to that, and that's really, I guess, twofold. One is over the longer term, right? We talked about strategic versus dynamic or tactical, and that strategic with that 10-year view is very much valuation driven. And the U.S. today is quite expensive versus the rest of the world. Now, we could have said that at any given point in time over the last 10 years.
Yeah.
So you take that with a grain of salt, but to the extent that trees don't necessarily grow to the sky, the relative expensiveness of the U.S. does serve to reduce expected returns. And so looking out over the next 10 years, our expectations for non-U.S. stocks is roughly 8% as of the end of last month, while U.S. equity return expectations are about 7%. And some of our peers actually have U.S. equity 10-year return expectations well below ours. And so with reversion to the mean, it is a real thing over the long term. It does make sense to diversify some of your U.S. exposure into the rest of the world. But sitting here today, we would deem the current environment to be one of resilience with different regions moving at different speeds led by the U.S. But in periods of strong coordinated global growth, And particularly in periods, and one of the things that has been, I guess, odd or an exception to what is normal over the last decade plus is coming out of a recession. And the last recession that we've seen was kind of COVID induced.
There hasn't been a recession since like 2000. I don't even know what year would it be? 10, it was, 8, 7, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. Coming out of the global financial crisis, really.
Right.
And that was, you know, 2007 to early 2009. But in periods of strong coordinated global growth and coming out of a recession, the rest of the world typically outperforms the US and really led by emerging markets, right?
Yeah.
And so if we were to move to such of an environment, we would likely look to tilt our positioning outside of the US a little bit more through that shorter time horizon lens as well.
Interesting. Well, a lot to know, a lot of information to absorb. Hopefully we got some points across about diversification, some things to look at in terms of understanding what your actual return is from a risk-adjusted return basis. And we're going to have all the show notes and the information on how to get to you, Tom, and understand about your portfolios that you have over at Franklin Templeton Investment Solutions, FTIS, I guess you call it for short.
Yep.
FITS. There's no really good way to say that short, I guess. No. But we'll have it on the show notes. Episode number 894 over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Tom Nelson, thanks for joining me again. I appreciate it. And that's going to wrap it up for this episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me. Next week, we got Kerry Lutz coming on, and he's going to be talking about, well, what he talks about. He talks about gold alternatives and what's going on in the world from the Financial Survival Network. Thanks for joining me this week and every week. I'll see you again real soon. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.